from my heart, from my mind, from my strength, I will worship you.
Book of Judges, chapter 7. We've been watching the Israelites go through these cycles, up and down, up and down. They trust God for a while. They do well. God brings them peace, and then they get comfortable, and then they tank. They take a dive, and they start following after other gods, and God has to make things rough for them, hard for them, to get their attention, to get them to turn themselves around, and then God raises up a deliverer, someone that in the book of Judges we will call a judge, not a king. They get confused with kings. They look like kings. They sound like kings, but they're not kings. They make it very clear that they're not kings, but they are the people that God will use to lead the nation and to get the nation set back up right. They're judges because they will, through God's help, they bring judgment on the nation. They help people clarify what's right and what's wrong. Men and women that God used. Last week we talked about, was it last week we talked about Deborah? Or was it 2 weeks ago? I don't know. God uses men and women. Very, very good stuff. Gideon is the guy we're looking at now. He's a man from the tribe of Manasseh. He is living in the town of, I keep wanting to say Oprah, but it's Ophrah. He has an encounter with this individual that we have seen, will continue to see, this angel of the Lord. And God calls Gideon to deliver the Israelites from the oppression of the Midianites. For 7 years, the Midianites would come swooping in every year at harvest time. And all of their hard work and all of their savings and all of their crops would get hauled away by these Midianites. Gideon started the work through him. First thing he did was he tore down his father's altar to Baal. His papa had an altar, had a pagan thing going on. And the first thing he did was he tore it down. Then he blows the trumpet to gather an army. And then he laid out the fleece where he wasn't really sure if God was really, really wanting him to be the guy. And there's that whole thing at the end of chapter 6 about laying out the fleece. The purpose, some people use this idea of a fleece, of trying to determine God's will. This isn't about determining God's will. This is about confirming God's will. God had already clearly spoken to Gideon of what he wanted, but the fleece was to be a confirmation that he was on track. So chapter 7, in chapter 7, Gideon's 300. Now, I don't know if anybody saw the book. I won't ask for hands because it was a movie that some people thought was too violent, and that's okay. But there was a movie that came out in 2006 about a famous Greek battle between the Persian army and the Greeks at Thermopylae. King Leonidas and his band of 300 Spartan held off 2 million, apparently, advancing Persians, held them off long enough for the rest of Greece to organize and to repel the Persians. This is the trailer of the movie. So when we talk about 300, we talk about 300 warriors, outnumbered 300, I'm afraid some people nowadays think of the Spartans. That was in 480 BC. We're about 1300 BC. We're about 900 years earlier. And there's a little bit of difference between Gideon's band of 300 and Leonidas' band of 300. Leonidas' band was known for their warrior qualities and their great fighting skills. Not quite so much with Gideon's. Leonidas' men would go down in history as the greatest fighting men ever. The story we're going to look at tonight is not about drawing attention to Gideon's men, but it's all about drawing attention to God. Verse 1, chapter 7. Then Jerubbaal, that is Gideon, and all the people who were with him rose early and encamped beside the well of Harod, so that the camp of the Midianites was on the north side of them by the hill of Morah in the valley. Now, mentions Jerubbaal, and I just got to just make sure, in case you missed last week, this is one of Gideon's nicknames. His papa named him this when he straightened his papa out about the worship of Yahweh. After he tore down his daddy's altar, his daddy got a clue, and he nicknamed him the guy who contends with Baal, the guy that gives Baal a hard time. That was a good thing, an affectionate thing that his dad called him. And Gideon gathers his men at a place called the Well of Harod. In Hebrew, it would be Ein Harod. Harod means trembling or terrified. That's an appropriate name, you're going to find out. Guys, let's gather an army and let's all meet up at the trembling place. it's great. Let's look at it on the map. Gideon gathers his people at Ein Harod, which is here. He's from Ophrah. Ein Harod is about 5 miles east of Ophrah. It's at the base of the Gilboa mountain range. And across the valley from Ein Harod to the hill of Morah, it's about 4 miles to this hill on the other side. So that's kind of the setup here. It's close quarters. It's close to Gideon's hometown. I mean, my gosh, if they built a little tower in Ophrah, they could watch the action. I mean, this is all very, very close. This is one of our places we like to visit in Israel. This video is from our 2008 trip. It was raining that day. It's a freaky thing. This is up against this bottom of the hill at the bottom of Gibeon. This is what they call the Ein Harod, the well of Harod, or Gideon's well. There's a spring there that comes through this cave. And the water comes out, and then they've built this little thing for the stream to go across. You can see Greg and Lauren walking across. And then the water goes off, and they've built a nice little park there, and it's a family thing, you know, and it's a very lovely place. This is on the way out. It's lined with bougainvillea, and it's a very beautiful place. If you stopped on the way out and look across the valley, that's the hill of Morah. So that gives you a little bit of perspective of how close this all is. Gideon and his men are, I'm guessing, possibly even up in the hills of Gilboa, looking across where the Midianites are at this hill of Morah. So it's close. You know why they call it the Well of Trembling? Okay, that the Midianites are camped out, spread out, 135,000 of them. They show up every year. This is like they're like snowbirds, you know, that show up in Arizona, you know, and camp out in Arizona. Well, these guys come in from the desert and show up. Verse 2, and it says, "And the Lord said to Gideon, 'The people who are with you are too many for me to give the Midianites into their hands, lest Israel claim glory for itself against me, saying, my own hand has saved me.'" Now, you're going to see that Gideon, when he blows the trumpet and gathers everybody together and says, "Let's get us together an army, let's fight the Midianites," He will gather a whopping big army of 32,000 men. God says, that's too many. And I'm sure Gideon's thinking, wait a minute, I thought they had 135,000 men. And you're saying, we got too many? What? You know, it doesn't quite make sense, God. Because God wants to make sure that people get this straight about who's winning the battle. This is so unlike the Spartans. See, the Spartans, it's all about the glory of battle, you know. And he tells his men towards the end, they will sing songs towards us, about the great battles that we have fought this day. You know, and giving up their lives for their nation. That's not what this battle is about at all. God doesn't want the glory to go to Gideon. God wants the glory to go to himself. Jesus said that when we do good works, he says, let your light so shine before men that they see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven. In Isaiah 42, it says, God says, I am the Lord, I am Yahweh, that is my name, and my glory I will not give to another, nor my praise to carved images. God doesn't want to share his glory. Now, is this because God is a spotlight hog? He's the guy that always wants to try out for the lead in the school play and always wants to get the, you know, always wants to be up in front of everybody and everybody going, oh, wow, you're so cool. Is it because God's so insecure or something he needs this? No, gang. It has nothing to do with it. You don't put our ego problems on God. God wants to get the glory because God is the one who really has the answers. Sometimes when we do things, I do them in a way so that everybody knows that I was the one who did this grand thing. And I don't mind a few pats on the back. I want people to know how awesome I am. The problem is that people start looking to me for help in their lives when they need to be looking to God. Because he's the one that changes lives. He's the one that has the real help that we all need. And so whatever we do, it says, whatever you do, do it all for the glory of God. Why? Because we want to make sure that people see God, that people understand that he's the one. When you look at this battle with Gibeon, with Gideon, oh my gosh, there's no way humans pulled this off. This had to be a God thing. Now he says, verse 3, he says, now, therefore, proclaim in the hearing of the people, saying, so this is what you're supposed to do. This is how he's supposed to handle the fact that he's got too many. He proclaims in the hearing of the people, saying, whoever is fearful and afraid, let him turn and depart at once from Mount Gilead. And 22,000 of the people returned, and 10,000 remained. So he says, okay, this is what you're supposed to do. You tell everybody, whoever is afraid, leave. Now, actually, this was supposed to be standard battle tactics for any Israeli army. We know this from Deuteronomy 20. God gave them rules of how to do battle. And it says, before you do any battle, it says the officers, Deuteronomy 20, verse 8, the officers shall speak further to the people and say, what man is there who is fearful and faint-hearted? Let him go and return to his house, lest the fear of his brethren faint like his heart. And so we're told why they're supposed to send them home, because fear is contagious. We don't want fear to spread among the troops. And the principle, well, I'm going to call this the principle, don't run away. I came across a quote from G. Campbell Morgan, great preacher of old, long, long days ago. And he said this, the fearful and trembling man God cannot use. Now, I have a problem with that. Because right in this very same story, you're going to see that the guy who's the general, Gideon, is fearful and trembling. My gosh, they're gathering at the well of trembling, for Pete's sake. The issue is not whether you are a fearful person. The issue is that God doesn't want you to run. God doesn't want you to be a runner. Fearful men can fight. Fearful men can stand strong. The point in asking people to go home is that God doesn't want you running from the battle. in the battle, because that's what's contagious. A senior gas company training supervisor and his younger trainee were out checking meters in a suburban neighborhood. They parked their truck at the end of the alley and worked their way to the other end. At the last house, a woman in her kitchen window was watching the two men as they checked her gas meter. Having finished the meter checks, the supervisor challenges his younger coworker to a foot race down the alley back to the truck just to prove that the older guy can outrun the younger guy. As they at last come running up to the truck, they forgot to check who had won because they both realized that the lady from the last house was huffing and puffing right behind them. And they stopped immediately and asked her what was wrong. Gasping for breath, she said, "When I saw two men from the gas company running away from my house as hard as you two were, I figured I'd better run too." Don't run away, because it's contagious. When I run away, it makes other people want to run away as well. That's the idea of what's happening here with Gideon. Because you notice, does Gideon go home? No, Gideon doesn't go home. Just because you're afraid doesn't mean God can't use you. Paul warned us about our spiritual warfare. He says, "Therefore, take up the whole armor of God, that you may be able to withstand in the evil day, and having done all, to stand." We might be fearful of what's up front in front of us, and that's natural. If you aren't afraid, there could be something wrong with you. The issue is, am I going to run away, or am I going to learn, as Paul says, to stand in the day of battle? Verse 4. So, 22,000 people have left. 10,000 guys have stayed. Verse 4. But the Lord said to Gideon, "The people are still too many. Bring them down to the water, and I will test them for you there. Then it will be that of whom I say to you, 'This one shall go with you,' the same shall go with you. And of whomever I say to you, 'This one shall not go with you,' the same shall not go." He says, "I will test them." And the word is like a word that they use for testing metals, for refining metals. What you're going to see is that the test involves how these guys are going to drink water from the spring of Harod. How are these guys going to drink water? And it looks like maybe, you know, Gideon's kind of, you know, they're probably going, "Well, what's this all about? Why do we all have to stop and get a drink of water? You know, maybe it's just, you know, we're going to run exercises or something." Who knows what Gideon's got in mind, you know? It looks like he's just telling everybody to get a drink of water. But it's really a test. It looks like something simple, but it's really a test. Warren Wiersbe writes, he said, "I heard about one leading pastor who always took a drive with a prospective staff member, always took a drive in the other man's car, just to see if the car was neat and if the man drove carefully. Now, whether or not neatness and careful driving habits are always a guarantee of pastoral success is debatable, but the lesson is worth considering. More than one prospective employee has ruined his or her chances for a job while having lunch with the boss, not realizing they were being evaluated." Pop quizzes. You never know whenever they're going to happen. You never know when you're going to be evaluated. Verse 5, "So he brought the people down to the water, and the Lord said to Gideon, 'Everyone who laps from the water with his tongue, as a dog laps, you shall set apart for him by himself. Likewise, everyone who gets down on his knees to drink.'" So remember, God said, "Get everybody down to the water, get them drinking, and I'll tell you how to separate them." So this is where now the instruction comes. The people don't know that they're supposed to have, that there's a difference. They're just knowing just to get a drink of water. "So the number of those who lapped, putting their hand to their mouth, was 300 men. But all the rest of the people got down on their knees to drink water." Now, there's the word that's translated as "the dog laps." The word for lapping up the water is lekak. To lap, to lick, to lap up, lekak. It's one of those words, like our word boom, where it sounds like what it means. Lakak. That's kind of the idea. It's one of those, what do they call it, an onomatopoeia word or something. I can't remember English, something like that. Onomatopoetic or something. Come on, teacher, is that not, something like that? Well, whatever. How dogs lick up water. This is very interesting. Slow motion. Did you know how dogs drank? Look at that. Look how the water curls up under the tongue. Now, I found some other interesting footage about dogs drinking. How could you be mad at those little eyeballs looking up at you? I was wishing that Lauren Bird was here tonight because she likes pugs. Now I don't think that's where they were looking for the guys who drank out of the toilet. That wasn't what the test was. Some people have suggested that it's not about drinking with the tongue, but more the idea of bringing the mouth up to your hand up to your mouth with the water. In fact, that's kind of what verse 6 is hinting at. Now, some people have suggested that this was all about a test for vigilance, that the guys who were being careful to watch and being vigilant of the enemy were the ones that had their heads up looking, you know. It could be, but to me, it almost, I'm just not quite sure I see that. I think the whole point is to, because the idea is not to pick the better men. The idea is just to get it down to 300, I think. Because remember, the idea is not to get the best, most awesomest men so that they can claim victory. The whole idea is to give God the victory. Verse 7. Unless it means vigilant in the sense of keeping their eyes on Gideon and following his instructions. Now, that will be important, as we'll see. Maybe that's part of it. Verse 7, then the Lord said to Gideon, by the 300 men who lapped, I will save you and deliver the Midianites into your hand. Let all the other people go, every man to his place. This would come by the 300. And there's a principle, gang. It doesn't take many. You know, if I was Gideon and I'd see that we've divided everybody into two groups. There's one group of 300 off to the side, and there's a group of 9,700 sitting over there. I would think God would be saying, it's the 9,700, those are the guys. And we'd be going, okay, well, at least it wasn't the 300. But it's not. It's the little group of 300. Jonathan, in years to come, would know the same principle. Back up. 1 Samuel 14:6. Then Jonathan said to the young man who bore his armor, come, let us go over to the garrison of these uncircumcised. It may be that the Lord will work for us. For nothing restrains the Lord from saving by many or by few. If God is on your side, you've got enough. That's kind of the principle. If God's on your side, you've got enough. Verse 8. So the Lord took provisions. The people took provisions and their trumpets in their hand. And he sent away all the rest of Israel, every man to his tent, and retained those 300 men. Now the camp of Midian was below him in the valley. So I kind of think they're probably up in the hills of Gilboa looking out across that valley. And it happened on the same night, on that same night that the Lord said to him, arise, go down into the camp, go down against the camp, for I have delivered it into your hand. But if you are afraid to go down to the camp with Purah, your servant, and you shall hear what they say. Afterward, your hands shall be strengthened to go down against the camp. Then he went down with Purah, his servant, to the outpost of the armed men who were in the camp. Now, Gideon is told that God wants Gideon to go down into the camp and check things out before anything else happens. God is going to have Gideon kind of spy on the people. And keep in mind, these are days where there is no television, there are no magazines, no newspapers, no photographs, no printed wanted posters, wanted Gideon. This is a troublemaker. I doubt, even though the Midianites will have heard of Gideon, I doubt that you pick 100 of them, I'll bet none of them would be able to pick Gideon out in a lineup. He doesn't have to be the master of disguise when he goes down to this camp. They have no uniforms. There are no, the Midianites all have pretty blue uniforms and the Israelites have little red uniforms. No such thing. You probably can't tell the difference too much with them. And he tells him in verse 10, if you are afraid to go down, then bring your servant with you. Now here's a clue here. You got this? If you're afraid to go down, then bring your servant with you. How many of you want to bet that he brings his servant with him? So what does that tell us? He's afraid. So when people say God can't use fear, people who are afraid, I beg to differ. Because Gideon himself is afraid. So verse 12. Now the Midianites and the Amalekites, all the people of the east were lying in the valley as numerous as locusts, and their camels were without number as the sand of the seashore in multitude. And when Gideon had come, there was a man telling a dream to his companion. So he walks into the camp, and it's you know, and he's hearing guys, you know, sit around a campfires and telling stories and stuff. And this one guy is telling his dream to his companion. And he says, I have had a dream. To my surprise, a loaf of barley bread tumbled into the camp of Midian. It came to a tent and struck it so that it fell and overturned and the tent collapsed. It's got to be a pretty good size loaf of barley bread. A pretty substantive loaf of bread. I mean, this is the kind that gets you sick to your stomach. You know, this is heavy stuff. The companion answered and said, this is nothing else but the sword of Gideon, the son of Joash, a man of Israel. Into his hand, God has delivered Midian and the whole camp. So this guy tells us his dream to a friend. And the friend interprets the dream. It's a loaf, it's about barley bread. Barley bread was the poor man's bread. Wheat bread was a little bit nicer stuff. Barley bread is the stuff that you'd also feed your oxen and your donkeys and stuff like this. This is why they pick it out as the Israelites, these poor Israelites that we keep ripping off, the guys that are hiding up in the hills. And he says, this is none other than the sword of Gideon. It lets us know that the Midianites are aware of Gideon. They're aware of him. They might have their own spies in the camp of the Israelites. Who knows? Now, Gideon has already seen some pretty cool things happen. Think about the things we looked at last week. He's had this angel of the Lord come and you know, he gives an offering to God and the angel sets it all on fire with his magic staff, you know, this incredible stuff. He's had the fleece thing, you know, one night the fleece was wet and the ground was dry, and the next day the ground was wet and the fleece was dry, and all this stuff, this amazing, miraculous stuff happening. It appears that it still hasn't been enough to convince Gideon. And so God sends him down into the camp to give him a sense of what he's up against. Now, frankly, I don't think I would blame Gideon. I don't know if I was called to be the deliverer of, of the nation, and there's 135,000 Midianites scattered in the valley, and the biggest army you can raise is 32,000. I'm not sure that I'd really want to be that guy. You know, I don't think Gideon's reelection chances are very good coming around in the next election. I mean, you want us to do what? You know, this is kind of crazy stuff. And so I'm not struggling that Gideon's afraid. He needs more. He needs more. And beloved, God wants to help our weak faith. God uses this man's dream and the interpretation all outside of Gideon's realm of influence. He's just watching. And God uses this to stir up Gideon and to show him that he is at work in this whole thing. In one episode with Jesus had been up on a mountain for a few days, and he came back and he found a mess. His disciples had been faced with a demon-possessed boy whom they were unable to help. And Jesus rebukes his disciples for not having faith. But then it says he asked his father, "How long has this been happening to him?" And he said, "From childhood. And often he has thrown him both into the fire and into the water to destroy him. But if you can do anything, have compassion on us and help us." And Jesus said to him, "If you can believe, all things are possible to him who believes." And immediately the father of the child cried out and said with tears, "Lord, I believe. Help my unbelief." I think that's an honest prayer. And I think that's something that God honors. You know, when God puts stuff before us that looks a little bit too big, a little bit too much, it's okay that I think God understands that you struggle with it. But God wants to help stir up our faith. It's okay to ask God to increase your faith. Don't use that as an excuse for not doing anything. Don't say, I'm struggling with this, so I'm not going to do anything. Because see, you ask God to stir up your faith, God is going to respond. He's going to challenge you. And he sends Gideon out down into the enemy camp, for Pete's sake. And yet that's what God uses to stir him up. Verse 15. "And so it was, when Gideon heard the telling of the dream and its interpretation, that he worshipped." He hears this story. And he worships. "He returned to the camp of Israel and said, 'Arise, for Yahweh has delivered the camp of Midian into your hand.'" He worshiped. The Hebrew word shikach, to bow down, to prostrate himself. Falls down on the ground. I'm looking forward to Sunday. We're going to talk a lot about worship this Sunday. We look at what happens in heaven. And those crazy elders in heaven, they know how to worship. And they respond to the other worship in heaven with their own worship. He worshiped. He saw God's hand. Gideon followed God's instructions. He'd torn down his father's altar. He'd gathered the army. He even shrunk the army down to the size that God wanted. And now he has gotten a peek at what was going on in the enemy camp. And Gideon finds out that while he has been doing all the things that he's been doing with the Israelites, God has been at work at the same time in the hearts of the Midianites. Even while Gideon has been doing his stuff, all the while God has been preparing the Midianites for their defeat. And he responds, Gideon responds with worship. He sees God's hand in this. It's not coincidence. It's like, well, that's an amazing dream. Purah, did you hear what he just said? That's quite a coincidence. No, he sees God's hand in this, and he worships God. Verse 16, "Then he divided the 300 men into three companies, and he put a trumpet into every man's hand with empty pitchers and torches inside the pitchers." So he divides the whole group up into three companies. So there's 100 guys in each company, and they're going to surround the entire camp of the Midianites. Are going to spread themselves all around the camp, and they've got torches inside of pitchers. The torches will be burning inside the pitchers, and when the pitchers are broken, then the light suddenly flashes. They don't have little flashlights with little on and off buttons. And so how do you make the light appear suddenly? You stick the torches in the pitchers, and when you get the signal and you break the pitchers, suddenly everything lights up. That's what's going to happen. There's a function to this whole thing. And he said, verse 17, he says to his men, "Look at me and do likewise. Watch And when I come to the edge of the camp, you shall do as I do. He tells his men, I want you to watch me. I want you to watch me. And even though God's the one who's going to do this marvelous thing here, God is still using a leader. God still has a leader, Gideon. And he's going to set an example. And so, you know, sometimes when we talk about God being at work, sometimes we make it so fuzzy that we just all sit back on our sofa and we're just going to watch God work. No, God's going to use a man, and he's going to be an example. And he tells everybody, you watch me. Keep your eyes on me. Maybe that's that vigilant thing. Maybe that's the lapping up the thing. I don't know. But they all have to watch him, and he sets the example. Men and women, we set the examples. We set examples for people to follow. Verse 18, he says, when I blow the trumpet, I and all who are with me, then you also blow the trumpets on every side of the whole camp and say, the sword of the Lord, or the sword of Yahweh, and of Gideon. That's what they're supposed to all shout out. The sword of the Lord and of Gideon. Now, remember the Midianites' dream? They've already used that phrase, the sword of Gideon. They've gotten that much. But it's going to get clarified, and the order is going to be changed around because it's not really just the sword of Gideon. It's the sword of the Lord and of Gideon. And so they're going to get their theology straight when this whole thing breaks out. This is not just the sword of Gideon. This is the sword of the Lord and of Gideon. The Midianites are going to know it is Yahweh who is fighting for the Israelites. And they're supposed to blow the trumpets on every side. Now, the typical way that an ancient army would function, we've talked about this, about the use of trumpets. Why do they blow trumpets? Sometimes it's to gather an army. Sometimes it's to control the army. You know, a certain toot, toot, toot means to go this direction. Another thing means to go this direction. One means advance. Another one retreat and all this kind of stuff. They didn't have walkie-talkies. That's how you communicate to the larger crowd, was with the trumpets. So the typical thing is for an army to have the guys in the trumpet, one guy blowing the horn, and then there follows the army after the horn. Whether it's to attack or retreat or advance, whatever. With each of the men, each of the 300 men, each having their own trumpet, it's going to look like there's this incredibly massive army out there. It's going to get the Midianites the idea that they're surrounded on all sides and there's people coming from everywhere. That's what's going to happen. So Gideon and the 100 men who were with him came to the outpost of the camp at the beginning in the middle of the watch, just as they had posted the watch, and they blew the trumpets and broke the pitchers that were in their hand. The middle watch, that places in around 10 p.m. That's when what was called the middle watch would begin. So this battle is going to begin at 10 o'clock at night. Verse 20, then the three companies blew the trumpets and broke the pitchers. They held the torches in their left hands and the trumpets in their right hands for blowing, and they cried, the sword of Yahweh, the sword of the Lord and of Gideon. And every man stood in his place all around the camp. Look at that, they stood. They didn't run. Every man stood in his place all around the camp, and the whole army, that's the Midianites, ran and cried out and fled. So the whole army, all of the Midianites run. The Midianites, they all wake up. They're going, where's the alarm? Who set this thing off? What, they're waking up and stuff. And they wake up. They're confused. They think they're surrounded by a huge army. And they all start fleeing from the trumpets. So here's this big group, and they're surrounded. So they all start heading towards the center, 135,000 men. And as you read the descriptions of this army, they are all kinds of people. They're not just Midianites. They're Amalekites. There's all kinds of different people coming in. And so the people coming in from the west run into the people coming in from the east. And they all, and there's no uniforms in those days. You know, the Midianites look just like the Israelites. And they're hearing the trumpets blowing, and they're watching guys run at them with swords. And let alone that it's all happening at night, at 10 o'clock, they start swinging their swords. They start killing each other. Verse 22. When the 300 blew the trumpets, the Lord set every man's sword against his companion throughout the whole camp. And the army fled to Beth Acacia towards Zererah as far as the border of Abel Meholah by Tabat. Abel Meholah. So follow the red line. See, this is the battle takes place up here near, up here. Here's Herod. Hill of Moreh is up there. Battle takes place, and they're heading towards the Jordan River. Here's Abel Meholah. And so the Midianites are going to follow this red line. That's going to be their path of flight. And the men of Israel gathered together from Naphtali, Asher, and Manasseh and pursued the Midianites. Those are all the tribes surrounding that particular area. And so they've got tribes coming in from Manasseh. Some of it's over here. Some of it's over here. Naphtali, Asher. The Israelites start gathering. Then Gideon sent messengers throughout all the mountains of Ephraim. That's down here in the southern area below where they are. Mountains of Ephraim. Saying, come down against the Midianites and seize from them the watering places as far as Beth Bara and the Jordan. Then all the men of Ephraim gathered together and seized the watering places as far as Beth Bara and Jordan. Now, so the Ephraimites all head out this way. Here's Beth Bara is here. They're to head them off, to keep them from going down too far into the valley. And that's going to make the Midianites take a left at Sukkot and head up into the hills of Edom. Verse 25, and they, this is the Ephraimites, captured two princes of the Midianites, Oreb and, I want to say Zeb, but it's Ze'eb. Oreb and Zeb, that kind of sounds like a cartoon character or something, I don't know. And they killed Oreb at the rock of Oreb, and Ze'eb they killed at the wine press of Ze'eb. They pursued Midian and brought the heads of Oreb and Ze'eb to Gideon on the other side of the Jordan. Now, this particular event itself, killing Oreb and Ze'eb, these two Midianite princes, they're called. This is one of the classic victories in the minds of Israel. And several places, if you can keep this, if you can somehow log this into your head, there are some places, like, for example, Psalm 83. It says, make their nobles like Oreb and like Ze'eb. Yes, all their princes like Zeba and Zalmunna. We'll meet those guys in a little bit. But you will see this as... you know, we think about things as tragic as 9/11. Well, we know what we're talking about, 9/11. With them, they talk about the great battles like in the days of Oreb and Ze'eb. You know, this is one of those key battles. You'll see it in the book of Isaiah as we're reading through Isaiah. It mentions Oreb and Ze'eb. I want to go back and talk about the broken pitchers just for a minute. There's a principle here. We call it light through brokenness. Part of God's strategy for these 300 was to break the clay pitchers that held the torches. The light couldn't be seen until the pitchers were broken. Follow me with that? They all got these clay pots. They've got these burning torches inside, but you can't see them until they break the pictures. You with me with this picture? It paints a picture that I think you can see in Paul's letter to the Corinthians. Once you are familiar with this picture, you can see this in what Paul says, 2 Corinthians chapter 4. See if you can look for clay pots, look for light, and look for how the light is seen. Paul says, even if our gospel is veiled, it is veiled to those who are perishing, whose minds the God of this age has blinded, who do not believe, lest the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God, should shine on them. In this context, what's the light? The gospel. It's who God is. It's who Jesus is. It's the good news about salvation. And he's saying those who don't believe have a blindness on them. You follow? That's kind of what he's saying. He says, verse 5, for we do not preach ourselves, but Christ Jesus the Lord, and ourselves your bondservants for Jesus' sake. For it is the God who commanded light to shine out of darkness, that was when God created things, who has shown in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Christ. But we have this treasure. What's the treasure? The light. You following me so far? We have this treasure in earthen vessels. Light in clay pots. You follow me so far? That the excellence of the power may be of God and not of us. I kind of think that like when Paul's writing this, he just had his quiet time in the book of Judges, and he just finished a story about Gideon and the clay pots and the God getting the glory and all this kind of stuff. And he says, we've got this treasure, we've got light that's been stuck in these clay pots, so that when people see the light, they realize, you're a stinking clay pot. This isn't you that's so great, it's the light that's in you that's so great. Are you following me so far? He says, verse 8, but we are hard-pressed on every side, yet not crushed. We are perplexed, but not in despair, persecuted, but not forsaken, struck down, but not destroyed, always carrying about in the body the dying of the Lord Jesus, that the life of Jesus also may be manifested in our body. Let me make a suggestion. That there's a death that comes when the pot gets cracked. When the clay pot gets broken, like there's a death. And the good thing about the death is that the life may be manifested. You don't see the light till the pot gets crushed. Right? For we who live are always delivered to death for Jesus' sake, that the life of Jesus also may be manifested in our mortal flesh. So then death is working in us, but life in you. There is a principle here, gang, that as hard as tough times are, and as much as we want to run from them, there is a sense that if we would do this right, if we're clinging to Jesus in our hard times, that even when I am crushed, it only goes so far. You know, I may be, you know, broken, but I'm not despairing. And when I'm hurting, good thing about having a pot that's cracked is that the light comes out. And when I'm clinging to Jesus in my difficult times, there is light that comes through brokenness. When people watch a Christian go through a difficult time correctly, I don't always do it correctly. I like to whine and cry and, you know, poor me and all this kind of stuff. But when I do it correctly, people see that I'm clinging to Jesus, that my life is all about Jesus. They see the light through my brokenness. You don't see the light till the clay pots are broken. Let's try to do one more chapter. I don't have as many stopping points in the next chapter. Chapter 8. Let's finish up the battle. I had a couple more pictures. So there we got the clay pots. You break the clay pots, and there's the light. Okay, done with my pretty pictures. Chapter 8. Now the men of Ephraim, remember they're the guys that are in the southern, a little bit south of where the battle was, up in the hills. The men of Ephraim said to him, to Gideon, why have you done this to us by not calling us when you went to fight with the Midianites? And they reprimanded him sharply. Why have you done this to us? They are upset with Gideon because it looks like that they are late to the party. They did not have the honor of being invited to the opening ceremonies. And they are upset with Gideon. I mean, yes, God has finally kicked out the Midianites, but they didn't get to be a part of it. You know, some people are just never satisfied. No matter what you do, there will always be people who will find fault with what you are doing. That's just life, isn't it? It's just life. There's always going to be somebody who's not happy. This elderly couple was having trouble with forgetfulness. So they went to their doctor. He said, why don't you try writing down everything so you'll remember? So one evening, Grandma asked Grandpa if he'd like some ice cream. Sure, that sounds good, but you'd better write it down. No, Grandma said, I can remember that. Would you like chocolate syrup on the top? Well, yes, but you'd better write it down. Oh, I can remember that. How about some nuts on top, too? Okay, but I really think you better write it all down. No, I can remember. So she went into the kitchen, and she was there for a long time. Finally, Grandpa went in and asked her what was taking her so long. Well, she said, well, I made you bacon and eggs. Grandma said, well, I told you to write it down, Grandpa said. I wanted toast, too. Some people are just never happy, no matter what you do. From a human perspective, Ephraimites have a point. You know, Gideon, if you were better organized, you would have sent out invitations, you know, a few weeks earlier. You know, you would have had all your ducks lined up. Why? You could have done this better, buddy. We could have really conquered them in a tremendous way, though they have already conquered them in a tremendous way. But, gang, the truth is, Gideon is not in control. And he's following God's leading. That ought to be a good thing. So he said to them, I like this. He said to them, what have I done now in comparison with you? Is not the gleaning of the grapes of Ephraim better than the vintage of Abiezer? Remember who Abiezer is? What's Abiezer? Anybody? It's Gideon's family name. It's his little section of Manasseh. He's from the family of Abiezer. And he says, you know, the gleaning of Ephraim, you know, your secondhand stuff is better than our best stuff. Kind of what he's saying to them. God has delivered into your hands the princes of Midian, Oreb and Zeeb. And what was I able to do in comparison with you? And their anger toward him subsided when he said that. You know, he's saying, look, you know, you guys are just awesome, you know, and there's nothing that we could have done that was ever as good as what you did. You guys got the two princes, Oreb and Zeeb. You know, you guys are really awesome. There is a point here about humble words. Too often we respond to angry words with angry words, and we just stir things up. Proverbs 15:1 says, a soft answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. You see in Gideon, you see a bit of the peacemaker here. He's the diplomat. He's complimenting them, and he's going to calm them down. He actually is going to pull it off. When you are confronted with people and they're mad and they're angry at you, you can respond with anger and, you know, all that kind of stuff, but it's just going to make it worse. Now, verse 4, when Gideon came to the Jordan, he and the 300 men who were with him crossed over exhausted, but still in pursuit. Look, he's still got his 300 guys with him. And you're going to see that they can do more than blow trumpets and break pitchers. They can do more than that. Then he said to the men of Sukkot, please give loaves of bread to the people who follow me, for they are exhausted, and I am pursuing Zeba and Zalmunna, kings of Midian. Sukkot is just as I mentioned, we turn inland off of the Jordan Valley, and just up into the hills is Sukkot. Gideon's looking for a little help here. You know, they've been, I don't know if they, it kind of sounds like they've been running all night. You can make a point that they've outrun their supply lines. They've run out of food. They just need, you know, can you just spare some snacks and maybe some Twinkies or something, you know, for us? Can you help us out? And the leaders of Sukkot said, are the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna now in your hand that we should give bread to your army? They say, well, you know, it's nice that you're one of us, you're an Israeli and everything, but man, we have to live with these guys. And if we help you, we're in big trouble. If they end up winning this battle, I mean, who do you think you are? So Gideon said to them, for this cause, when the Lord has delivered Zeba and Zalmunna into my hand, then I will tear your flesh with the thorns of the wilderness and with briars. Now, wait a minute. I thought he was the peacemaker. And now he is in their face. Now, is it just because he's like cranky and tired and he's been running all night? And how dare they, you know, maybe just like add it up to here? It could be. But, you know, there is a time to be firm with people. There is a time when it's appropriate to be firm. The people that he's gentle and peaceful with are the people who have been fighting with him, alongside of him, helping him out. The people of Sukkot are sitting on the sidelines just saying, we don't want to help. We don't want to do anything. So there is a little bit of something behind why he treats one group with gracious words and another group with harsh words. The people of Sukkot don't want to be a part of the battle. Then he went up from there to Penuel and spoke to them the same way, and the men of Penuel answered him as the men of Sukkot had answered. Penuel, that's a little bit further up this valley. It's from the river Jabbok. By the way, these names, Sukkot, Penuel, and Jabbok, these are places where Jacob camped out when he was coming back from Haran, from back in the book of Genesis. This is where he met an angel and all kinds of stuff happened in the same area. Where am I? Penuel. Okay, verse 9. So he also spoke to the men of Penuel, saying, So he goes to Penuel, and he says, can you guys help us out? You know, can you open up your in-and-outs for just a few hours and feed my guys? You know, all your 7-Elevens are closed. Help us out here. And they say the same thing, like, no way, buddy. So he also spoke to the men of Penuel, saying, when I come back in peace, I will tear down this tower, because they had an awesome military defense tower thing. Now, Zeba and Zalmunna were at Karkor. That's off the map here. That's like way down here somewhere. They were at Karkor, and their armies with them, about 15,000, all who were left of all the army of the people of the east. For 120,000 men who drew the sword had fallen. This is where we actually get the numbers of the size of the Midianites. It's from this verse. These guys have 15,000. There's already been 120,000 killed. So you add that up, and that's why we think that the Midianites had 135,000 men. Verse 11, then Gideon went up by the road of those who dwell in tents on the east of Nobah and Jogbehah, and he attacked the army while the camp felt secure. They thought that they'd made it safe home and they're all secure, and he attacks them. When Zeba and Zalmunna fled, he pursued them and took the two kings of Midian, Zeba and Zalmunna, and routed the whole army. Now, just in case you were thinking that the entire victory over the Midianites happened when they turned on each other, think again. Because now, Gideon and his little 300 start swinging their sword. And they still have some incredible odds, don't they? 300 versus 15,000. I mean, if the story started out that way, I wouldn't want to be a part of that, would you? Let alone 135,000. This is still incredible odds that his 300 are facing. Then Gideon, the son of Joash, returned from battle from the ascent of Heres, and he caught a young man of the men of Sukkot. That was one of those places that didn't want to help him, and interrogated him, and he wrote down for him the leaders of Sukkot and its elders, 77 men. And he came to the men of Sukkot and said, here are Zeba and Zalmunna. Because they said, where are those guys? How do we know that you're going to be? And he said, well, here they are, about whom you ridiculed me, saying, are the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna now in your hand that we should give you bread to your weary men? And he took the elders of the city and thorns of the wilderness and briars, and with them he taught the men of Sukkot. Now, it says he taught the men. This is... he whipped them with thorns. He tore their flesh like he promised. Then he tore down the tower of Penuel and killed the men of the city. And he said to Zeba and Zalmunna, what kind of men were they? So now he turns to the Midianite kings and he says to them, what kind of men were they whom you killed at Tabor? That's the original battle. So they said, as you are, so were they. Each one resembled the son of a king. What they're suggesting is that Gideon looks like a king, and these guys look like his brothers. Gideon finds out, you can see the Kennedy, there's the Kennedy look, right? You know, it's the same kind of a thing. It's just like somebody looking at Teddy Kennedy, you know, before he died, and look at the other pictures and say, these guys look like you. The same idea. Gideon finds out now that his brothers were killed by these guys. Then he said, they were my brothers, the sons of my mother. As the Lord lives, if you had let them live, I would not kill you. And he said to Jether, his firstborn, Gideon's firstborn, rise, kill them. But the youth would not draw his sword, for he was afraid because he was still a youth. So Zeba and Zalmunna said, rise yourself and kill us. For as a man is, so is his strength. So Gideon rose and killed Zeba and Zalmunna and took the crescent ornaments that were on their camel's neck. So apparently it was some kind of a badge of honor to ask his son to kill these kings. And he was a little bit scared to do it, so Gideon did it. And he took the crescent ornaments. Camels in those days wore these like things to ward off evil spirits. They were in honor of the moon-faced goddess Astarte. So there's a little bit of a taking away of idolatry that's involved with removing these crescent ornaments. Then the men of Israel said to Gideon, rule over us, both you and your son and your grandson also, for you have delivered us from the hand of Midian. And Gideon said to them, I will not rule over you, nor shall my son rule over you. The Lord shall rule over you. They are so blown away with gratitude towards Gideon. And they say, you know what? You ought to be our king. And Gideon says, I am not your king. Now, I don't know of a lot of people who would turn something like that down. Gideon is smart enough that even though God called him to lead the battle, God has not called him to be king. He knows his calling. It's not uncommon for people to egg people into places that they don't fit. And Gideon knows his call. His call was to lead this battle, and that was it. Oh, man, I'm out of time. And I got this really funny story I won't have time for. Oh, it's a really funny story about a circus and a guy, this is back in the Depression, and the guy gets a job as the gorilla because the gorilla had died, and they skin the gorilla, and he wears the skin, and he makes a living by being the gorilla in the circus. And one day he's jumping up and down, and he's so excited about doing this job as the gorilla that he jumps and accidentally finds himself in the lion cage. And he freaks out and he runs and he jumps to the top of the lion's cage and he's holding on for dear life. And the lion starts to walk up to him really slowly. And then the lion says, you think you're the only guy that's working here? And something like that. I don't know. It'd be better if I'd read it, but that's the joke. Anyway, a mark of maturity is knowing how to be comfortable in your own skin, what you're called to do, to know what your limits are. This is where I'm supposed to be and no more. Then Gideon said to them, I would like to make a request of you that each of you would give me the earrings of his plunder. For they had golden earrings because they were Ishmaelites, these Midianites is what they're saying. That was the style of the day. All the guys had earrings. So when they killed them all, they took all their gold earrings. Now, the Bible says that a workman is worthy of his wage. So in a sense, you could say maybe there's nothing wrong with Gideon asking for this. So they answered, we will gladly give them. And they spread out a garment. Each man threw into it the earrings from his plunder. The weight of the gold earrings that he requested was, 43 pounds of gold is what it comes out to. Verse 27, then Gideon made it into an ephod and set it up in his city Ophrah. And all Israel played the harlot with it there. It became a snare to Gideon and to his house. Now, what's an ephod or an ephod? It's some kind of a religious priestly thing. I usually think of it as a garment, but they're kind of making with its gold thing, they're kind of thinking maybe it's some kind of a breastplate or something like this. And the actual Jewish tradition is that he did this as a way of honoring God somehow. But what happens is that Israel starts to worship this thing. It's a snare to them. And there's a lesson here, gang, that we want to learn So not just fight well, but to finish well. It's important that we get through the crises correctly, that we do well as we go through the crises, the battles. We also want to finish well. Paul talks about running the race and being trained by God, 1 Corinthians chapter 9. In verse 27, he says, I discipline my body and bring it into subjection, lest when I have preached to others, I myself should become disqualified. You want to run to the end of the race and do it well. So verse 28, Midian was subdued before the children of Israel, so they lifted their heads no more, and the country was quiet for 40 years in the days of Gideon. This will be the last time of peace that Israel will have during the times of the judges. There's no more. They had 40 years of peace. After this, it's going to be one battle after another. Then verse 29, Jerubbaal, the son of Joash, went and dwelt in his own house. Gideon had 70 sons who were his own offspring, for he had many wives. And his concubine, who was in Shechem, also bore him a son whose name was Abimelech. So this guy has 70 legitimate children from many wives, but he has a concubine, another woman on the side in Shechem, and she has a kid named that he names Abimelech. Abimelech, you'll see that this will become a title of Philistine rulers, Abimelech, but it means, Ab is the word for father. You stick an I at the end of a Hebrew word, it means it's possessive, it's mine, it's my father. Melech is the word for king. My father is king. That's what they named. Now, I don't know if the kid, maybe named himself that. He wanted everybody to know that he was Gideon's son. We're going to see him in the next chapter. He's going to cause a lot of trouble. Verse 32, now Gideon the son of Joash died at a good old age. He was buried in the tomb of Joash's father in Ophrah of the Abiezrites. So it was as soon as Gideon was dead that the children of Israel again played the harlot with the Baals and made Baal Berit their god. It's one of the gods of the Philistines. Thus the children of Israel did not remember the Lord their God, who had delivered them from the hands of all their enemies on every side, nor did they show kindness to the house of Jerubbaal in accordance with the good that he had done for Israel. They're going to turn their back on Gideon's family. And we're done. The cycle begins again. Let's stand and pray.